Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. My name is Vivian Roberts, and I'm co-founder and artistic director at Aleph Contemporary. Today, it is my great pleasure to introduce our two speakers, Dr. Kamini Velodi, in conversation with Lawrence Noga about his virtual solo exhibition online at Aleph Contemporary. Lawrence Noga is an artist, curator, and writer. He lives and works in London. His paintings and constructions combine an industrial and geometric aesthetic with more personal themes and undercurrents. A sense of history comes from collective and individual memories, as many of the elements, such as the support of the painting, are from his father's collection of objects and memorabilia in his garage. Hundreds of tools, packets, washers, menus, books, and photographs. Their selection and use activates an open approach reliant on the environment and experimentation, alongside a human response to the mysterious and forgotten items and their poetic sense of history. A long-term interest in the Bauhaus, particularly Moholy Nagy, Joseph Albers, and Paul Klee, drives the predictability of the color handling and surface facture. Lawrence Noga currently teaches at University of the Arts London, Camberwell. He graduated from Wimbledon College of Art and completed his postgraduate studies at Byam Shaw, Central St Martin's University of the Arts London in 1991, receiving the Postgraduate Award of Merit for Fine Art. Kamini Velodi is a writer and artist and senior lecturer in philosophy, theory and history of art in Edinburgh College of Art at the University of Edinburgh. Her research intersects 20th century and contemporary continental philosophy and theory, and theories and historiographies of art history and visual culture. She is the author of Tintoretto's Difference, Deleuze, Diagrammatics, and Art History, published by Bloomsbury in 2019, and is series editor of Refractions at the Borders of Art History and Philosophy for Edinburgh University Press. She studied painting at the Royal College of Art and Chelsea College of Art and holds a PhD in philosophy from the Centre for Research in Modern European Philosophy, Middlesex University. She is currently working on two books, one on the concept of grey in art and philosophy after Hegel, and the other a dictionary on Deleuze and Guattari's writings on the visual arts.
Okay, hello. I'm really thrilled to have been invited by Lawrence and Vivian to write the catalogue text for this show and to have the opportunity to engage now in a dialogue with Lawrence about it. Yesterday, Lawrence and I met for a preliminary chat about what we might discuss today, and we thought we might structure this dialogue into four parts, beginning with some brief reflections on the show and then moving on to the question of memory and obsolescence, followed by thinking a bit more closely about the relation between symbolism and formalism in the works, and finally turning to the question of time and the instant. So hopefully we'll have time for all those things. But I thought, so maybe we can just start very simply with talking about the works and their installation, what's in the show in an empirical way. And maybe Lawrence, you could just tell us a little bit about the specific group. For instance, was it conceived as a singular body of works?
Well, the works were conceived partly as a singular body, but also the work has a kind of sense of history to it. So I think that history is kind of the relationship really between the works. And I think that's probably at the core of the kind of show, particularly in terms of the kind of construction of the work and the kind of idea of the memory that's lodged within the work. So that really kind of identifies how I probably decided to put the work together. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the work itself, they very much come from my own memories, I suppose, that take me back in time quite a long way to my childhood home, and my father's garage in particular, where he was in a kind of obsessive collector of memorabilia, and really he collected many things from the restaurant he worked at. It was the Caprice restaurant in the West End. So old menus, that kind of idea, bits and pieces he found around the restaurant, but also from other places he went. He did a lot of gardening, so he collected little things from probably people's sheds. So for instance, there were hundreds of packets lined up across the garage, quite systematically, I have to say. So they just weren't randomly placed. They were quite systematically kind of ordered. So I think there was science, some kind of system in his head. And then doorknobs, he was really interested in doorknobs. So he'd have these kind of collection of doorknobs, again, systematically placed through color, through kind of size and scale. And they were kind of, actually even sort of placed quite strategically on kind of a wood support in the space as well. And then on top of that, there were just hundreds of tools as well, which kind of were stacked on long shelves and all around the space. So these kind of tools, if you were, kind of stayed with me. And his father was a carpenter before that. So this kind of idea of shared experience is one that certainly kind of came passed down to me. And perhaps, as well as that, my mum was a singer, a jazz singer. So we had this kind of also lots of musicality in the garage as well, old speakers, plenty of old music scores. She was interested in jazz, so lots of improvisation music, and standard things that she'd sing. So there was this kind of this mixture of kind of identity that the garage kind of held in a way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting you speaking sort of about, so we're talking about the found object and the way in which there was a particular kind of horizon of that for you, because what's found is sort of found in the garage in a site, and that site is loaded, with these memories, with these very specific life story. And so there's already a kind of maybe an imminent sort of systematization to the found object. I'm really fascinated by the fact that the packet's already arranged and there's a kind of the hint of the form to come or something like that. And that constructivism is somehow suggested by the kind of the tool or the thing that's found. Is that a fair way to maybe describe it or begin a description?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I know in I left the house with my dad, we took everything with us and I just boxed everything up and I just took it away with me and put it in my studio. And over time, I kind of began to, kind of undo the boxes and start, finding what was in the boxes. Sort of surprising, things that were in there. Just because I didn't know how I'd packed them up quickly. Suddenly I was kind of, this whole kind of new horizon of things emerged. But then after he kind of passed away, I started using them, very much in response to that memory, I guess. And the sort of physicality of those shapes probably started to direct the work. For instance, there was a semicircular shape that was part of a bar in the restaurant he used to work in. And so I attached that to one of the paintings quite intuitively in a way. Other items, like, as I said, mentioned the doorknobs, those things are kind of creeping in perhaps behind me here a little bit. Washers, those kinds of things. I think this kind of sort of memento, sort of color mementos kind of crept in as well. So I suppose this amalgamation of kind of collage was beginning to kind of have a depth of quality and a depth that started to develop the structures.
Mm. It's really interesting what the notion of a color memento, because I think symbolism here, you know, already takes on two registers, both the kind of visual qualities, properties, but this is very sort of very specific, very loaded, and you know, associations. And I was also struck by the what you talk about. There's a sort of the rediscovery. So the kind of, you know, that somehow, you know, it seems interesting to me that things have been packaged and maybe not forgotten, but sort of put aside and then rediscovered. So, you know, that there's a sort of a kind of return to the site that's displaced and not there. And construction or constructivism also then takes on a different type of dimension. You know, it's certainly beyond the sort of not only about formal assemblages, but symbolic ones too.
No, I'm in tune with that, really. I think that kind of symbolism in terms of those objects is, you know, again, have equal weight. You know, I think there's equal weight between the sense of symbolism and equal weight with the kind of more constructive approaches that I use in the making of the work. That weight is quite an intuitive thought to begin with, but then as the works start to kind of develop, and they're quite slow, I'd say, to a certain extent, they probably take sort of months in some ways, maybe even longer, just because I work on, you know, probably a number at a time, but then I get generally probably stuck on one, like this one that you talked about here. Again, I think I come back to that a lot. It's, you know, it's had lots of different phases where it was just wood in the bottom part of it. And then I thought, actually, I'm sort of starting, I quite like to see what happens if I paint it. So that started happening. And then I kept building quite slowly the layers on the top part of it as well. So that's often done with kind of things, you know, palette knives, quite soft brushes. So again, that kind of very slow, methodical kind of build up of the structure of it. Is aligned with the whole cut, those two ways of thinking.
I mean, there's two things I want to ask you. So, I mean, one is about, I guess, the selection, the way you decide what objects to select when, you know, you have this massive reservoir of possible objects, and whether there is a kind of visual and material language that you're working with and you've constructed over the years, and that's also part of the not predetermination, but the kind of the shape shaping of what you decide to select. And the other question, I guess, is about the tipping point between constructivism and pictorialism. We started to talk a little bit about this yesterday, because that seems to be really key here, that, you know, you're constantly negotiating a boundary. You know, you could call it the boundary between object and pictorialism as well, or other things. And I remember you said something about, was it the constructions as questions and the paintings as statements, which struck me at the time. So yeah, maybe you could answer.
Yeah, I think the kind of the constructions ask questions of the past and time, you know, that I think that's very much how they kind of operate, and also, you know, the time and spent making them. I think that the sort of painting side of it, and the kind that also is referential to sort of weight of color, I think. You know, it might be, for instance, you know I'm quite interested in how grays balance off primary, secondaries, tertiary colors balance off that. So I'll use a lot of grays, blacks in the work to kind of counter that all the time. And also the sense of thinking about quite punctuating color, like perhaps pinks, you know, the way a pink might kind of really shift the way the painting's understood from front to back. So there's that's something I often use to kind of articulate a kind of depth of space, or a really kind of quite sharp lemon yellow, which again will kind of facilitate that depth of understanding in the work. I mean, I always refer to the sort of my work in a way as is sort of a peripheral. It's kind of got, and the geometry is quite imperfect. So in a way, there's some slippage quite often with the paint. It's not always totally hard edge. It has those softer moments. I mean, I use quite a lot of masking tape, but there's quite a lot of freehand approaches in the painting as well.
Mm.
So those combinations are always kind of happening for me.
I'm going to pick up on what you just said about grey there. I think you know what's coming. There's no idea of, we were talking about Paul Klee yesterday and the Bauhaus, your interest in the Bauhaus and constructivism and Bauhaus colour theory. And something I've been interested in is Paul Klee's notion of grey, the grey point as the tipping point between chaos and composition, the kind of punctum of pictorial genesis. Do you invest particular colors? You just talked about the sort of the hinge between the primaries and the secondaries, and that's how Klee saw gray, because it had no opposite, which is also something I guess sort of useful in thinking about Genesis, that there was a way of thinking about Genesis as a reservoir where all potentials are somehow contained, which in some peculiar way also brings us back to the idea of a garage as a sort of reservoir where lots of potentialities are contained, maybe many further into the future one doesn't know about. Is that something that occurs to you, that kind of investment of color or sort of spatial to particularities of the work as punctum or tipping points or, you know, catalyst?
Yeah, no, I think the work, well, I often use grays in for the grounds as well. So that often activates the whole style of the painting anyway. Sometimes I'll use an emulsion ground, because again I quite like that sense of flatness to start the painting, so I might use that. I'm always looking for a kind of whole range of kind of gray tones and dark tones, because I'm sitting at my table, but again kind of lay down the whole table, I guess I reset it most days, but there are kind of 20 or 30 grays kind of lined up on the table, table, something I can just push around the studio, but so they're always there balanced against the rest of the color that I might use, so it's kind of always kind of that the possibility of that of that kind of color slipping in, maybe even silvers, you know, as well, kind of more iridescent color.
What does it do? Is it a neutralizer, or is it a reservoir?
I think it's a counterbalance, really. I think and also it creates this odd depth of field, I think. You know, if you think of sort of more lens media, where you might use kind of a black and white kind of structure in a photograph, then I quite like that odd depth of field that perhaps the gray tonal shifts will create. So perhaps that's something that kind of sudden density, you know, that really acts, that will be helped by those gray tones.
That's really interesting. And also, I suppose there's something about grey, because it doesn't declare itself, it allows other things to be declared. So it is, as you say, a perfect ground, but it's a mobiliser. So I think, you know, that's what interests me about the way Klee uses it. It is an activator without actually calling any attention to itself. So it suspends itself while pointing to other things.
No, I think that you're absolutely right. That kind of arrow to that particular color. Klee actually uses arrows in his paintings, so I often use this kind of pointed mark. But I mean, I'm also interested in the way that the kind of grays might be sandwiched between the colours. You know, perhaps it's, you know, it's in a clay, it might be sandwiched between some chalk, some gouache, some watercolour, some, you know, kind of maybe some oil as well. So, you know, those things starting to kind of coalesce with each other. Somehow he makes it happen, and the kind of magic occurs through this kind of build-up of the surface facture. So that's what always excites me about Clay's work, is the fact as that kind of build up that sometimes you're not even aware of until you get quite close to the painting, and often as that intimacy of the painting, of course, drags you in close to the scale of it.
Well, that's really interesting, that the question of, I think, you know, stratigraphic layering of which is both it's a material thing, and of course it's a temporal thing too, and that's operating both formally and again symbolically for you, in terms of sort of the layering of memory, the layering of these sort of vestiges of stories, some hidden and some, you know, less so, as well as the build-up of a surface. That's a very interesting thing. And I remember you speaking about intimacy and in relation to both that kind of stratigraphic compositional approach, but also in relation to, well, to scale. And scale seems to be incredibly important in this group. Something very specific about the selection. Maybe you want to say something.
I tried to be, in a way, quite kind of diverse in the selection of the work, but also kind of shifting the kind of viewpoint around the space from something with a kind of handle in it, a metal handle props at the top of the painting, to something which we talked about yesterday, a kind of long band painting that you kind of coined yesterday with me, which I liked. One thing that sprung to my mind yesterday, that one of the band paintings that's in the show has my dad's kind of medals painted onto the surface of the painting. So these little kind of symbolic moments happen in the paintings. Obviously they're kind of hidden from everybody until I explain this little strip, band is part of a bigger band on one of the longer paintings. And then there's a little leather sort of washer that's kind of attached to the painting as well. So it just kind of upsets that sort of flatness. And that sort of focal point of the washer kind of pulls you into that, to the surface, I think. So I'm quite interested also in something that always draws the viewer into the surface. It might be something like the washer, or it might be something like the Meccano that I've used in this painting. I guess, luckily, my dad somehow collected Meccano as well. And for some reason, and he had Meccano magazines in there. I don't know why he had them. But he never really spoke about Meccano, but there, you know, it was all sitting there. And in this painting, I think there's collage made up of a Meccano magazine in there, but there's also the Meccano kind of itself.
I suppose it comes back to the question of how, if there's a criteria for how you select, how you come to certain objects. And I remember yesterday, we spoke about the sort of multiple functions that these obsolete signs, I've called them the obsolete signs, take sometimes to trigger associations and seeming to act as a kind of source of the construction, so propelling an idea, and at other times interrupting the meaning of a story that's already that you've already embarked upon. Like you were telling me yesterday about the one to your right. was a sort of, in some ways, a response to an existing landscape, an existing environment. And then
the one to my right is more about my studio, APT, Deptford. And I've been here for a long time, but I love my studio because it's quite high up and I'm surrounded by trains going past me and a kind of landscape of architecture that has kind of developed over a long time. And the creek is just below me and I'm kind of looking onto that. And I wanted to make something, a painting which kind of had that history about this place and how that's kind of emerged as well. So the kind of structure behind me has a kind of quality of the creek itself, how the creek has high walls to it. And I wanted it to feel like you were kind of at the top of these high walls in the painting. And then also this sense of geometry and windows into people's lives all around us as well. I can see, you know, pretty much into a lot of people's windows and things, but I think it's a very old thing. I mean, I was like, oh gosh, you know, and they must see me painting, you know, as well all the time. So it's a kind of strange thing going on out there, and trains flash past me, you know, as well. So it's an odd kind of thing, really. But everything's happening about all the time. I feel a lot of reflections as well.
Maybe we could talk a bit more about, you know, this, what compels you to pick up certain objects and select them from the mass of ephemera.
I think, I guess, you know, again, it's kind of intuitive. I'll perhaps see something on the floor, or I'll perhaps see something in a wood bin, or I'll see something that catches my eye. You know, I think artists are good at that. You know, they're always seeing something that catches their eye, and it might be this tiny piece of wood, or it might be a as I said, a kind of a washer or an old piece of ruler, or part of another tool, a form that I've got a shine. It's shiny, or it's got color, and it again, I kind of think, oh, that might work in this. So yeah, beyond the kind of collection in the garage, I think other things from workshops, you know, where I teach, come sliding into that. Things that
I've interesting. I mean, do those objects from different sources, the non-garage sources, do they acquire or contain a different value for you symbolically to the garage objects?
That's interesting. I think they do, but I think that they all sort of contain some kind of depth of memory about places I've been or occupied for a long time. I quite like kind of somehow the consistency of place. You know, I tend to stay in places a long time, I think. So, you know, I don't know why, I just do. But and maybe that history kind of builds up a little bit, I think. And perhaps you know, you were talking about Bachelard in your text, and that sense of the past and the present moving together, happening at the same time, and I think that's a good way to think about it, really. Although it's in the past, it's very present in my thoughts, and I think that really kind of shifts again the work for the viewer. I think you know, what one could be thinking about the past, but suddenly something, because of possibly narrative or history or an incident, you know, propels you back into the now. And you know, I think those things are very kind of phenomenologically based for me.
I was very interested in how these the obsolete signs, the objects, function as moments of discontinuity, and that they introduced a rupture to the experience of continuous motion in space and circulation of shapes. And as you said earlier, kind of actually are stopping points or stilling points, or thresholds, which is, I think, what brought me to thinking about what Bashar says about that being sent as a kind of collapse, but also poetics that, you know, heightens the feeling of the experience of a contracted presence outside of what duration can capture. So, you know, that's and it also calls for an act of kind of acute attention in turn. So it's about not only, I guess, the experience that you've had and are presenting through construction, through different constructivist operations, but the experience of, well, experiencing these constructions again, so how they're registered anew by someone who actually doesn't have access to that, to those memories or to that, you know, that particular archive.
No, I agree. It's it's quite subtle, I think, how those things register with viewers, or they might slowly register the kind of decisions in the work. And I think that's quite a good thing. I quite like the way that people may spend time with the work, and something immerses them into it. You know, so often we rush past works, we don't stay with them. You know, it's a few seconds perhaps. But I think I'm kind of hoping that something of the duality of kind of actions in the work will keep people a little bit longer, will create that tension, so they'll tune into it a little bit more. And that, I think that tuning in is something I'm quite, you know, captivated by, or trying perhaps to tune them into the partly the past, but very much that maybe their own present as well.
That's really interesting, you know, because it's suggesting, I think, you know, one could come to your works and think really they are primarily about spatial explorations, you know, that's how their primary mode of engagement. But, you know, the question of time is actually so key, it seems to me. It's so embedded in both the kind of roots of the works, but their experiential operations and mechanics, both in terms of obsolescence or something that's outdated. I mean, I'm interested in the nature of some of these objects as signs of processes that are outdated. I mean, it's difficult because they're so anonymous, but, you know, some of them, you know, look either stylistically or just reminiscent of things that we no longer need or use, you know. So it's not just that they've been discarded and found like a bus ticket, you know, it's that they are outdated, they're outmoded, like Walter Benjamin said, you know, and therefore, you know, obviously this quality of the outmoded, as he put it, has this sort of, obviously it's a revolutionary potential, but a potential to interrupt the kind of, I suppose, habitual domains of perception, and introduce a difference that makes us think and experience in intensive ways. I mean, I think in some ways there's this interesting crossover between that idea of the outmoded, and what it does to presentness and presence, and this idea of the instant and the kind of discontinuity, which is also the way, pertains to the way you treat geometry, which I think is quite a particular approach to geometry, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, I think the circularity of the outmoded form is quite an interesting idea, isn't it? Because often that outmoded approach, or outmoded object, or outmoded colour, or, you know, comes around the circle again. And that's perhaps what shifts the viewer or others into the work once more. That kind of quality of something that you know had a history to it. I mean, it might be a particular colour. It might be a kind of sap green that became feels part, past. How that kind of then, by introducing that slightly outmoded colour or something that we once loved and adored, suddenly is kind of placed in front of us again to kind of to question. Mm. So I think I'm interested in I'm sort of interested in systems, I must admit, but I think that the systems for me quite often are about choice of things like colour. I mean, I often go into a paint shop, an art shop, paint shop, and I just blindfold myself and just choose colours blindfolded, and it's a kind of system or a thing that I do, but it's a kind of thing that just maybe says, okay, that's the color I'm going to use, even, so it's a blind choice. Something I've done for years whilst making collages that often activate the paintings, small band collages, they are often made on old invitations. So I've got this thing in my head that I'm only going to use old invitations, and that's what I do the drawings or the collages on. And I don't know, I think they're thrown away things, but hundreds of them, but they're great. It seems to me that I'm happy working on them like my old maths books at school, I just wanted to kind of draw all over those, but it has a similar kind of idea in a way.
Well, I'm quite interested in that rule, the relation between the rule and the kind of organicity, if I can use that word, of the construction. Was that the case with this group or with any of these works, that there were predetermined choices and rules you followed?
Only from the choices from the blind colour choice. Mm. Or the kind of sense of that object I might find in the work. Going back to what I said before, objects that could come from my personal history or found objects elsewhere. So I guess they always come from those kind of two sources in a sense. I mean, even in this painting here, there's a reference to, there's some text in it, which is a reference to a show that, again, the whole studio had some years ago. So I sometimes like to include little references that are kind of perhaps just I know about, but perhaps others don't. But just in that case, it's kind of it's referential to that, to certain history and certain times again.
I mean, of course, we've talked about the outmoded with respect to formal properties, namely colour, and the outmoded with respect to the object sign. Of course, there's the outmoded with respect to genre as well, and the very genre of construction, assemblage, abstraction, perhaps. So, maybe you could say a little bit more about the question of that murdered and your investment of the histories of painting and object that are.
I think that's great. I mean, I think I curated a show some years ago, I think it's 2016 or 2017, called Imperfect Reverse. And I did that in conjunction or collaboration with Saturation Point. And I think at the time I felt that perhaps that relationship with constructivism and geometry and systems had got a little bit kind of lost, and people weren't really looking at it as much. And I guess I made a little bit of a decision to kind of pull that back into view, particularly with that show. And I kind of made a decision to pull in lots of slightly older artists with a really powerful kind of understanding of geometry and systems, and then, you know, younger artists as well, who were just starting to think about perhaps geometry and systems. So yeah, I feel that's important to me. And also in the way I might write about other shows or exhibitions at times, to kind of again pull people back into that kind of viewpoint. So yeah, I think that's a constant for me, I think, that I'd like people to reposition themselves, to think again about things they might not have considered. But I think that's good too, because again, it makes us think about perhaps painting differently and how we might kind of approach it again, differently, but with a little bit more kind of resolve, a little bit more energy, a little bit more kind of focus into the work.
Do you think about the dating of your paintings? I mean, are you interested in the possibility that it might be difficult to know when your works were made?
I think that's a really interesting idea, actually. I think, because sometimes the paintings do go on for quite a long time. And also, like I guess many painters, but, every now and again, you can't come back to it. I just feel that I sometimes know exactly when they're done, but then occasionally some pull you back in again. And I think that is a kind of, that's when there's a little bit more hard won in terms of the way they might be developed. I think a lot of artists who make kind of geometry in their painting and work would like a kind of them to almost look sort of faultless, if you like. They've kind of, there's effortless, faultless. They kind of have this kind of, that kind of feel to them. And I think that's quite, because that they've taken probably an absolutely extraordinary amount of kind of thinking and development to make the works, but sometimes you've got this kind of faultless feel to them. And that's quite a nice, I like that trick, if you like, that they feel kind of easy, but we kind of know they're not. The time taken and the kind of decisions and perhaps the slowness of those works has been important.
I mean, it's quite interesting. Yesterday also we were speaking about compulsion or in terms of, coming back to things. So this also complicates the question of when something is made, and I guess when it's finished, of course. But and you were speaking quite in an interesting way about the compulsion to return to the band paintings. We're calling them band paintings.
Band paintings, yeah.
Forever. And that's sort of existing in this kind of parallel space or stream to the more what I saw as additive explorations of your construction, where, to quote you, they're questions. They're sort of, one might even say they're sort of repeated questionings.
I suppose that kind of generative, there's a sort of generative notion in the works in that way. Going back to the collages, I make a lot of those on the discarded invitations, but then they could also kind of start to function in sort of multiples. They might sit on top of each other, or they might stretch. I can make decisions about how those works will be seen. What I quite like about them is they could be seen in multiple ways, perhaps. That they might be all stacked on top of each other, or they might be shown in a little group of eight. These kinds of more generative ideas often filter into the work. And I think that's quite exciting for me, that sometimes, I might make a decision to shift the way they're shown or put together. I mean, that might make it sometimes difficult to date, because of that kind of decision in the way I might play it. But I think I like the idea that the work is playful, And I think that, the games that kind of artists play, I think are quite always in the back of my mind a little bit as well.
Mm. I mean, I wonder, Lawrence, about the way you take apart a collection of things. So you spoke about collections of washers, collections of door handles, and other kinds of many collections. And I mean, maybe you have before, but not in this particular series. You know, we've got itemized, washers and you know, one or two. You know, it's a set that we can delimit. Is that something, you know, that you consciously, you know, you determine in advance, or has it ever occurred to you that the full set is kind of, I'm picturing, you know, infinite series of packets and things that actually are limitless, that sense that you can't, there's something about the notion of this garage as being uncontainable, unrepresentable somehow in its entirety that really intrigues me. So I was just wondering if you've ever sort of thought about, you know, or what, you know, the kind of pointed extraction from a group, how that works for you.
Yeah, I think it's quite an odd thing. My dad had also little tins of things. I was drawn back into tins. He's got an old black magic tin, condor tins. Full of things that he might be interested in. And so in my, in the studio again are lots of tins with things in. So a kind of system starts to creep in that the tin has the kind of things in that I might use. I think that's another, you know, quite humorous system that I kind of quite like. Mm. I guess that's one way of kind of thinking about it. I mean, he had lots of old toolboxes as well. So the toolboxes often contain packets in, as well as the packets on the wall. So a sort of inexhaustible thing, possibly. But I think I can have quite a lot of fun thinking about him and his kind of humour, and that's connected. Ins really.
I mean, certainly when I see the way you use nails and screws, because sometimes it's not clear to me whether they are found, you know, or they're part of a collection, or whether they are just, you know, part of the apparatus that you're using to install or something. I think that indeterminacy, that possible duality, is interesting, because that's the moment when we're reminded of the threshold at which a tool that might have been obsolete once more acquires a renewed function in a different context.
Yeah, I think it's it's about the kind of operation of those, you know, tools. I think how you know, how my dad might have used them, how, well, actually in a way he just had them, and sometimes they didn't get used, you know, they were just there for looking at. There were just jars screwed up into the shelf, you know those kind of, the jar screwed into the top of the shelf, and then the glasses screwed into the jar, and the nails or the screws just sit there, and you know, it's just, they're not really ever used.
Pure aesthetic for the aesthetic.
Yeah, pure aesthetic thing. It's just an aesthetic representation of those particular screws. Yeah, they just rust away, and you know, you just, little hooks
Maybe the last thing we can speak about we haven't as yet is the sort of the sort of dual register of the sign in terms of the visual and the sonic, and how, you know, that works. I mean, I think I mentioned in the text your other work, Deep Red Filtered Pink, there's again the kind of ambivalence of the disc, I think, you know, as a, both of a sign pointing to different registers and the sonic being enfolded in the visual somehow, and a lost function, but also again to that aspect of memory that you mentioned at the beginning of this talk, that's quite important to the genesis of the background of the works.
Yeah, I think in that particular painting, it's probably more about my mom and her kind of passion for music and you know, kind of voice, you know, and always singing in the house, and you know, that kind of those particular tunes floating in my head constantly, really. And and then also on that particular painting, she collected lots and lots of sheet music, so I also started to use little geometric qualities of the sheet music. So if I found a piece of geometry in the sheet music, I started to use that in this painting. And actually from that, you know, sort of period, 60s, well, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, there's quite a lot of geometry actually in the work, in those musical sheets. So again, I'm just pulling those out. Again, you might not notice that they have that kind of symbolism, but I think then you might just notice the parlophone or one of those kind of musical giants, you know, of the past, who are embedded into the painting as well. And again, I've used in that particular painting a kind of canvas that represents a disc. I've used perspex for sort of a kind of mirrored surface. The handle kind of starts to make us think of a kind of more human kind of experience, I think, of touching a handle every day and opening the door and all that, I suppose, again. I think this painting kind of looks at you. It's got one single kind of central, dare I say, eye to it, but it kind of blinks at you or looks at you. And I suppose that's how I feel about the painting in a way. It's almost blinking or registering you.
I mean, this sort of, I suppose that, you know, that very, very powerful triangle is countered, again, to use your term, the counterpoint between this cluster of circles, some of which are constructions, some of which are the objects, some of which are just screw heads, you know. But they pull it back and take the formal back into that, back through that threshold to the stories, you know. And then there's a kind of the visual language, which is teetering towards the graphic score, which is interesting. So there's all these different stratas to the constructions. And I think it's really fascinating how the obsolescence becomes a threshold that operates in multiple ways. It doesn't become a style that, you know, there's a trope that you just repeat again and again. It's almost continually recast. So it's even hard to know what it looks like in the end.
Yeah, I'm glad you noticed that in a way. I tend not to make the same kind of, well, I do make a series, but they have different elements to them, as you're talking about there. So those different elements or forms or possibilities are always interesting to me. I sometimes start with the intention of kind of creating a similar work, but I then somehow go off at a tangent, and it starts to become less similar. And so that's what it kind of excites me. I have made quite a lot, you know, so I'd say the handle paintings, as there's a few of those. Yeah, so I guess those exist, but each of them are kind of very individual. They don't have a kind of, the structure is slightly different in them. They might have a kind of a set of stairs in them, or they might, in some of the others. They often have some consistency of materials. Arno magazines, old railway train magazines, you know, railway collectors magazines, these kind of things I found, but because they were there. But yeah, so those things, but they're often, and I often hide, sort of bury those within the paint as well. So there's a kind of, those kind of multi-layers of what kind of hide me.
Concealed. Finally, Lawrence, I guess we could just end, but sort of saying, is there any one work in, you know, that is for you a sort of one that you keep returning to, or that has sort of acquired a particular kind of impetus or sort of significance for you in this group? Maybe there's not, maybe they're really, they're cluster. I just thought I'd ask.
I suppose actually the one we're just talking about, in a way, I think I do get drawn back into that particular painting quite a lot. I think because it has such sort of significances in terms of the kind of structure, the colour, the kind of layers of it, quite sad and melancholic memories, a bit melancholic. Bit traumatic, but you know, I think that those things, trauma, melancholia, I think they kind of are all part of me, you know, very much. And I think that, I think that's why that those things hang with me. It probably create, so I hope they create a kind of mystery, but I think, you know, they're the things I probably can't, I choose not to shake off.
Yes, you choose, yeah. And the insistence.
Yeah, I think so, yeah, that's true.
Well, thank you so much, Lawrence. That was really fascinating and a real, you know, treat for me, you know, to sort of probe you and, you know, about questions that are also really pertinent to me. And so thank you, really enjoyed that very much.
Really, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.